Hello, on this week's show we look ahead to the Philadelphia Orchestra's next season. We'll speak with music director Christoph Eschenbach about the process of selecting repertoire and what we'll be hearing in 0607. Can art be considered a sport? Albert Stumm reports on preparations by two local members of the US ice sculpting team for next month's Winter Olympic Games in Italy. There's been a lot of hoopla recently surrounding Benjamin Franklin's 300th birthday. Philadelphia Inquirer arts writer Edward Szyzanski wonders, what was it all for? Jason Pfeiffer tells us about regular visits he's been making to the Arden Theatre over the last several months to observe developments in the production of a new Michael Hollinger play called Opus. And in our regular exploration of the culture file section of GoPhila.com, Susan Lewis visits Mother Bethel AME. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra this morning releases details of its upcoming season. Using humor as a common theme, the orchestra will celebrate big birthdays of two musical masters, Mozart, who turns 250 on Friday, and Shostakovich, who would be a mere 100 years old. The Mahler cycle continues, and it will be the first full season that the Kimmel Center's new pipe organ will be heard in works by Elgar, Bartok, and Handel, among others. Former music director Riccardo Muti returns to the podium to conduct a week of subscription concerts, and other guest conductors include Valery Gergiev, Raphael Frubeck de Burgos, Maren Alsop, Vladimir Jurovsky, and orchestra associate conductor Rosin Milnov, while Philippe Jordan and Andrei Borevko will make their conducting debuts. Guest artists include pianists Andre Watts, Long Long, and Martha Argerich, violinists Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg, Leonidas Kavakos, and Gil Shaham, while six of the orchestra's own musicians will also appear as soloists. I spoke with music director Christoph Eschenbach earlier this week by phone from Paris. At what point do you start to think about programming a new season? Is it an ongoing process, or do you actually have to physically sit down and say, what have I achieved? How do I want to take those ideas forward? And does it evolve in that way?
No, it's a more an ongoing process. It's also, you know, in context, what I feel that the future seasons is not only the season which follows the one which is present now, but it's also to think what in future seasons I will do, what I do in other places also. But it's an ongoing thinking process.
We see that in the fact that we're continuing the Mahler cycle and we're starting to go into other cycles as well. There's a lot of Mozart and Shostakovich in the program, both of whom are celebrating birthdays. You make a point of pointing out that you want to emphasize the humor in the music of both of these composers. Humor is not something that classical music tends to talk about a lot.
Well, therefore I talk about it. And also, it's kind of a refined humor. I mean, Mozart is not just witty. And Shostakovich is not just sarcastic, cynical. It is a very refined sense of putting things into a place where they can be watched from a distance, like with a kind of an irony, which Mahler, by the way, points also out. And therefore, it's more complex, and certainly in the case of Shostakovich, it's very complex. I mean, if he turns into even a bit vulgar humor, like in the first piano concerto, in the first and the last movement, then it's just a contrast to the slow movement, which is pretty sad. And I mean, that said, the same thing happens in Mozart.
In one of the Mozart piano concertos, will be the first time that you will conduct the orchestra from the piano, if I'm not mistaken. Why is it taking you so long to take this on?
It's not so long. I mean, only three seasons with the orchestra as music director. But I have done, in 1990, I remember the Coronation Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducting from the keyboard. I see it as you know, as a fun to make chamber music in a broader style.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the guest artists, soloists and conductors that you're going to be having in Philadelphia. A lot of old favorites, Andre Watts, Long Long, amongst the musicians. But one does stand out, former music director Riccardo Muti returning for a full week of subscriptions. This will be greeted with a great deal of pleasure by a lot of Philadelphia Orchestra subscribers.
Yeah, that's what I wanted from beginning on. And first he was a bit hesitant to come, and then he came to the concert last season, which was very, very wonderful of him to do. And then we had actually an easy time to convince him to come back for a subscription week.
The new pipe organ will be fully functional by the start of next season, and it'll be fully functional in the coming months. How much will that add to the possibilities of what you can program?
Well, I mean, there are pieces which, I mean, one can schedule pieces with a electronic organ fine nowadays from technology standpoint. But it's so much more exciting if you have that organ in your hall, you know, and therefore we will have many pieces which figure the organ as a main factor of Kimball Center and the hall and our orchestra.
Philadelphia Orchestra Music Director Christoph Eschenbach talking with us earlier this week. The orchestra's 06-07 season opens on September 21st with a program featuring Mozart's Overture to the Marriage of Figaro, the Chopin Piano Concerto No. 1 with Long Long, and Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Over the past few years, the bitter legal saga between the famed Audubon String Quartet and its former violinist David Ehrlich has been played out in a very public fashion. Fired by the other three members of the quartet in 2000, Ehrlich successfully sued the group and was awarded in excess of $500,000, representing his share of the quartet's perceived worth. Most recently, an anonymous donor offered $200,000 to the remaining members of the quartet so that they wouldn't have to sell their instruments to pay the settlement. Now another contentious string quartet drama rages at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia, only this time it's fictitious. Michael Hollinger's new play Opus depicts the harmony and clashes between members of a renowned ensemble called the Lazara String Quartet. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has been following the development of the new production for almost 6 months and has this report.
Michael Hollinger's more than decade-long relationship with the Arden Theatre has been a fruitful one. Since 1994, the company has presented a new work from the playwright almost every 2 years. Arden producing artistic director Terry Nolan can think of few equals in the company's 18-year history.
The only writer whose work we've done more is Stephen Sondheim's. So here at the Arden, it's Sondheim, Hollinger, Shakespeare. So, he's a writer whose work we love.
It's apparent Hollinger also has affection for the Arden. He's happily taken most of his work to the company over the past 12 years. At this point in his career, when many theaters would jump at the chance to stage one of his new plays, Hollinger continues to return to the Arden, a place that's become a familiar artistic home. The making of Opus is also a return to some other familiar territory for Hollinger, the realm of music. A classically trained violist and graduate of Oberlin Conservatory, Hollinger once spent hours upon hours of his time practicing the viola, but ultimately put the instrument down for 18 years while building a career as a playwright. With such a strong background in music, Hollinger says he considered writing a play about a string quartet around 15 years ago, but was unsure how to go about it. He says that changed 3 years ago, when he started playing in string quartets again at the Settlement Music School in Jenkintown.
And I just loved it so much. It was a return to something that was always a cherished and intimate art form for me. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time for me to pull off this play now. Maybe I have enough craft to do this thing.
Although Hollinger wasn't able to immediately begin the writing of Opus 3 years ago, it didn't take him long to gear up for the task once time allowed.
I hit the ground and started writing rather furiously. And so the play actually was written in a much shorter time than most of my plays tend to be. In this case, I would say over the course of about 5 or 6 months.
Writing and refining a script, however, is only part of the scheme in creating a successful new production. Among other things, the right actors also need to be brought together. Before auditions even began last summer, director Terry Nolan and Michael Hollinger knew they wanted actor Greg Wood for Opus. Wood, a two-time Barrymore Award winner and longtime Philadelphia-based actor, has been in many shows at the Arden. I had the chance to sit through Wood's audition in July, and the rapport that he had with Michael Hollinger and Terry Nolan was apparent. Hollinger, for example, felt comfortable having a little fun with Greg Wood.
He sounded a little like Cheech and Chong in the audition, actually.
The mustache helped. The mustache helped. It really did.
Ultimately, they reached a consensus to cast Wood as Alan, a violinist in the Opus story. Greg Wood explains that he was eager to accept the job.
I actually changed a bunch of plans so that I could be available for the production, so because I didn't want to miss it.
Along with Greg Wood's role as Alan, there are four additional characters in Opus. Grace, a violist, Elliot, who plays the violin, Carl, the cellist, and Dorian, who plays both the viola and the violin. Dorian is a former member of the quartet, and the talented young Grace is his replacement. As the group comes to grips with the new dynamics of the ensemble, they're preparing for a high-profile performance of Beethoven's Opus 131 string quartet in C-sharp minor, called the greatest quartet ever written by one character in the play. One major challenge that Opus presents for its five actors is the need to look like a world-class quartet, which they, of course, are not. The cast spent almost an entire week of rehearsals just learning to create the illusion of proficiently playing their instruments, mainly focusing on the bow work, not the fingering. On the second day of rehearsals, back in mid-December, the cast members sat in chairs facing a television that played a video of musicians from the Curtis Institute of Music performing string quartet repertoire. Behind each actor was an instructor advising them as they mimicked the musicians on the screen. When Michael Hollinger wasn't sitting at a brown folding table referencing a biography of Beethoven by Lewis Lockwood, he was on his feet also coaching the actors, drawing on his extensive experience as a violist. Here he works with actor Erica Cuenta.
Let it come all the way up to the... That's it.
Hollinger's history as a musician is an asset to the premiering Opus production. Not only does the artistic team have access to him as a playwright, but also as an advisor on matters of music. While developing the play, it became clear that actors would not be able to produce the sound of a polished quartet performing the complex Beethoven work. The Arden team also knew they wanted to uniquely record and arrange the music for the show. Just any old recording of Opus 131 would not do. So they turned to the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, enlisting the help of a quartet made up of four Curtis seniors, Johannes Dickbauer, Lily Francis, Nicholas Kenilakis, and Jose Maria Blumenschein. Initially, the group had no name, but in anticipation of gaining some publicity, they chose to be called the Addison Quartet. Opus sound designer Jörg Kusino calls the team of accomplished but not yet established musicians a great find.
That was sort of what I was hoping for, that it's young, talented, ambitious musicians who want to be part of this without being too good for a production where we would alter their sound or we would, you know, edit it, so they were perfect for it.
Combining a proven playwright, seasoned actors, and established theater, and the hugely talented Addison Quartet from the Curtis might seem like a formula for a successful premiere. But director Terry Nolan explains that with any new play, there's no guarantee of having a winner.
No one knows how it will work. Even the plays that you read and you think you see so clearly, once you start to put them on their feet and you start sharing them with an audience, you can never fully guess how things are going to go. There's that unknown. There's the risk.
Risky or not, Opus will charge full steam ahead in the coming months. After a 7-week run in Philadelphia, the Arden's production will be transplanted to the City Theater in Pittsburgh. In February, an entirely separate staging will be undertaken by the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. According to the Arden, a number of other companies across the country have already expressed interest in producing the new show soon.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Opus is now at the Arden Theater in Philadelphia and runs through March 5th. Philadelphia Inquirer arts writer Edward Sazansky has been observing recent celebrations of you-know-who's 300th birthday. Here he asks, now, what was that all about?
I left the Benjamin Franklin exhibition at the National Constitution Center wondering if I'd really met the great man or whether I'd been so bombarded by fragments of his myth that the man whose grave lies just across Arch Street barely emerged from the visual and oral clutter. It's very difficult to bring to life a colorful and complex personality through objects and wall texts, as this show demonstrates all too well. It offers an outline of Franklin the legend, but leaves too many blanks in Franklin the human being. The show reminds us that history, like art and science, deteriorates when excessively popularized. I'm not overlooking the fact that the Franklin Show also functions as a major tourist attraction for the usually slow winter months around Independence Hall. It works on that level because Franklin was, in teen speak, such a cool guy, invented all those gadgets, helped to found what would become a great and virtuous nation, even, presumably, spoke French. Franklin is a man that Philadelphians and all Americans should admire. Yet beyond his coolness, the exhibition really doesn't explain why we should make such a public fuss about his 300th birthday. What does his life have to say to us that applies in 2006? Well, two things. Franklin was a creature of the 18th century Enlightenment, which meant he was intellectually curious about how nature worked. That's why he flew the kite, studied the Gulf Stream, and designed a stove that didn't smoke up the house. Whether for practical use or just to locate truth, he challenged received wisdom. He also saw the value in civic cooperation, in education for its own sake, and in philosophical give and take. He wanted to improve the quality of life and to understand it more completely. Intellectual rigor, respect for truth, and civic responsibility are all timeless virtues that are worth refreshing every century or so. Perhaps Franklin's example can inspire us to do that. This is Edward Sozansky.
Kevin Gregory and Tony Young picked up bronze medals in the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics in 2002 for ice sculpting. Yes, ice sculpting is an event. It's not an athletic contest, but it is part of the Cultural Olympiad, an artistic competition of sorts. Now administered by the International Olympic Committee, the Cultural Olympiad began at the 1976 Montreal Games as a way to highlight the host country's culture and to make connections between the arts and sport. It now lives on during every Olympic Games under varying names. This time in Turin, Italy, it's called Italy Art. Events include a five-month-long series of juried art exhibitions and performances, and in the case of ice sculpting, a two-day-long judged competition. Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm reports.
Tony Young with his 14-inch chainsaw. He's in the carving studio of the ice sculpture company he and his business partner Kevin Gregory run in Conshohocken in suburban Philadelphia. The small studio, maybe 6 foot by 10 foot, is located in a converted warehouse divided into rooms with thin plywood walls. Commercial freezers surround the studio, which is right next to another room where 16 custom ice block makers hum constantly. The machines circulate the surface water so the block freezes from the bottom up, creating a perfectly clear block of ice. Not like your freezer's ice cubes, which freeze from the outside in and end up opaque. Snow and sparks fly from the chainsaw as Young lops off huge chunks from a 300-pound block of ice. At Young's side lay other saws, a power sander, an assortment of chisels, flathead and curved, a blowtorch, and what looks like a cordless screwdriver with a conical drill bit. With this stuffed workbench, it will take Young about an hour to turn the 40-inch-tall block into an angelfish for a Sunday brunch centerpiece. As he works, snowdrifts form on the floor, later to be swept out the back. The angelfish is a standard, a sculpture that Young and Kevin Gregory have done dozens of times for repeat customers such as luxury hotels. Their sculptures have also been featured in large-scale productions such as the 2003 Super Bowl in Houston, Florida Governor Jeb Bush's inaugural dinner, and the NCAA Final Four in 1998. But those jobs just pay the bills. The real excitement, their real passion, centers around the competitions. The road to the Olympics began in 1990 at a vacation resort in Dixville Notch, New Hampshire. Gregory carved ice for the first time as an apprentice chef. Surprisingly, it was chefs, not traditional artists, who pioneered ice sculpting. Blocks of ice were needed to keep food cold on buffet tables. And with an eye for flawless presentation, French chefs began slicing up the ice in the 18th century. So for Gregory, and most other ice sculptors, what started as carving radishes into flower blossoms turned into a passion, and then a career, in ice.
Once I got into ice, I developed an instant passion for it and continued to try and learn and teach myself as much as I could about it.
Gregory finished the apprenticeship, and in 1993, he opened Ice Concepts in Pennsylvania at the age of 24. About the same time, Tony Young entered the same apprenticeship program in New Hampshire, which Gregory had just completed. And 4 years later, Young came to Pennsylvania to work for Gregory as a carver, later becoming a partner in the business. Since then, Gregory and Young have regularly entered and won competitions, placing themselves among the best ice sculptors in the world. But to Young, the designation as one of the best doesn't really mean anything.
I don't really think about that too much, because, I mean, you show up at a competition and your piece can crash and you'll be last place. I mean, you're the worst ice carver in the world.
They certainly are far from the worst, considering Gregory and Young, who together once carved a 7,000-pound life-sized chariot,
each qualified on their own to be part of the 7-strong U.S. ice sculpting team. Only 40 carvers from 28 countries will compete in Progetto, Italy, outside Turin. That puts the American duo in fairly elite company. Well, elite for the ice sculpting world, anyway. From experience, Gregory knows that his event will get but a sliver of the media attention accorded to, say, downhill skiing or figure skating. In Salt Lake City, the gold medal winner didn't even get his national anthem played.
It wasn't quite the hoopla of award ceremonies that you see on television in like, the, you know, the medal stands and whatnot. But they put together a nice award ceremony, and the Olympic Committee presented the medals and stuff like that. It was nice. We'll see what happens in Italy.
But Gregory and Young say they don't care about the hoopla. They're heading to Italy for the Olympics, and it's the competition that counts. All contestants were assigned one of four themes, and they will have 48 hours to turn 8 of the 300-pound blocks into either an abstract or realistic creation. Gregory, assigned to execute a realistic human form, plans a life-sized woman on a pedestal, reaching to the sky as her robe billows around her body. Young, who won't compete directly against Gregory, is charged with creating an abstract image in the Italian arts category. He intends to portray Botticelli's painting Birth of Venus, where the goddess emerges from a clamshell. A 9-member jury judges the sculptures on 10 internationally recognized criteria, including everything from overall execution and technical skill to how efficiently sculptors use their allotted ice. Back in the carving studio, Young puts the finishing touches to the angelfish with a blowtorch. Right now, the guys are praying for really cold weather in Italy. Every degree above freezing could potentially damage their work. But since they can't control the weather, Young says they'll focus on what they can control.
I'm going to hang out for 3 or 4 days, see as much of Italy as I can, you know, carve some ice, and hopefully we'll come away with some sort of medal.
But of course, there are obstacles. There are weight limits for passenger baggage on every plane, so they can't even bring all their equipment, giving the Italians a real home field advantage. And there are a lot of unknowns: weather, the language barrier, what to do if their chainsaws get lost in transit. Plus, the Japanese, considered perennial favorites, are always a threat. But maybe in these days of doping scandals and millionaire athletes, in what was previously a purely amateur arena, these guys still embody the true Olympic spirit, that it's not the winning that counts, but the simple honor of taking part.
WRTI's Albert Stumm. Now it's time for our regular dip into the culture file section at gophila.com. When this country won its independence from England, a segment of the population got left behind. Although there were some African Americans who were not slaves, neither were they citizens with equal rights and privileges under the new laws. But a strong African American community existed in Philadelphia, a focal point of which was a congregation which met on 6th Street, just a few blocks south of Independence Hall. With the biblical name Bethel, which in Hebrew means House of God, this group of worshippers would grow into the 3-million-member worldwide denomination known today as the African Methodist Episcopal Church. As Creatively Speaking Susan Lewis reports, today Mother Bethel AME continues its rich tradition of worship and community.
On a bright sunny morning at the corner of 6th and Lombard Streets in Philadelphia, people are arriving for Sunday services, as they've done for hundreds of years, at Mother Bethel AME. Let's go inside. The first thing that strikes you when you step into the front vestibule is, well, just how welcomed you're made to feel. Smiles and warm greetings shower everyone who walks in the door as people mill about the lobby. Ornate wooden staircases on either side lead to the second floor main entrance to the church and upwards to a balcony. We can hear muffled singing through the large wooden door to the sanctuary. Inside, families, couples, and singles drift in and find seats in the dark wood pews that curve around like outstretched arms towards the altar at the front of the church. And at the back, robed choir members sway, singing devotional music as the service gets set to begin. This morning's worship celebration, or something close to it, has been happening for over 300 years of Sundays on this, the oldest plot of land continuously owned by African Americans in the nation. Mother Bethel traces its beginnings to about 1790, when a group of African American worshipers left the parish of Old St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church. although St. George's had been one of the few integrated parishes of the time, beginning one Sunday after a renovation, a new policy restricted African Americans to gallery seating. This affront prompted Richard Allen, Absalom Jones, and others to walk out, says Mother Bethel's rector, Reverend Dr. Jeffrey Leith.
About 42 in all left St. George's Church, and two congregations emerged, the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas and the other Bethel Church, which we refer to as Mother Bethel.
St. Thomas African Episcopal would be led by Absalom Jones. Bethel, led by Richard Allen, would continue in the Methodist tradition. Services were held in Allen's old blacksmith shop, which he moved to 6th Street in 1791. In 1805, a new roughcast church was built. In 1816, a number of Bethel AME congregations had sprung up in the region, and the decision was made to officially form a new denomination. The 6th Street location, as the Mother Church, became known as Mother Bethel, and its leader, Richard Allen, was elected to be its bishop. As an institution with its own property, totally managed and controlled by African Americans, Mother Bethel gave its members more than a place to worship, says Reverend Leith.
It was significant as a place where thinking and ideals were being lifted up outside of the majority community. Not only were they able to vote, but they were also gaining skills in these various organizations on how to work cooperatively and how to compromise in order to get a greater good accomplished.
A charismatic leader like Richard Allen in an influential place like Philadelphia was a powerful combination, and Mother Bethel soon became known far beyond the city limits.
And that's why the church, for example, was important as a stopping place along the Underground Railroad. Fugitive slaves not only were helped by the church, but they were also spreading the notoriety of the church as they made their journey north, so that in the early 1820s, the church is known throughout New England and as far away as Canada.
A brick church served the parish during the years leading up to the Civil War. In 1890, it was replaced with today's Romanesque Revival building, which, thanks to a 1980s renovation, looks much as it did in the 19th century. With original pews, wraparound balcony seating, gas lighting fixtures that have since been wired for electricity, a pipe organ behind the pulpit, and most strikingly, large stained glass windows on the north, south, and west walls of the room, and a rose window above the organ. Reflecting both biblical and social themes, a number of these brilliant colored windows were donated by groups such as the Masons, the Odd Fellows, and the Grand Army of the Republic. These gifts, says Reverend Leith, testify to the vibrancy of the African-American community, which from the beginning was self-supporting but not isolated.
There were African-American artisans, craftsmen, but also professionals, but they were servicing the broader community.
In the restored sanctuary, whether you're standing alone or among a crowd of worshipers, you can sense the vitality of that community through the years. And as a picture of this life forms in your mind, there's more. Two stories down is the tomb of Richard and Sarah Allen and the Richard Allen Museum, which lies waiting to fill in the details. Among three galleries, we can find original pews from the early church buildings and the Liberty pulpit believed to be from the 1841 church, used by orators like the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass. An old wooden ballot box used with white and black marbles deposited to vote yea or nay testifies to the democratic processes people were using within the church. We glimpse the lives of the people of Mother Bethel, past and present, in personal effects, writings, and artifacts. A wall is devoted to women in the church, and a contemporary portrait celebrates Judith Jameson of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, who grew up around here. Today, Mother Bethel continues to reach out to people, and its role during its over 300-year lifetime has only grown. The Sunday Worship Bulletin now prints a welcome in 7 languages, and Reverend Leith knows that people come to this National Historic Landmark for all kinds of different reasons.
We get people from Japan, from China, from Russia, from all parts of Europe. When people come here, it's as though they are making a pilgrimage. There are people who may be African-American and not necessarily a member of the church who come because they revere Richard Allen and what the church and the denomination have represented in American life.
That report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. More information on Mother Bethel AME is available at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for another show. Our thanks this week go to Catherine Blodgett and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.